broadcasting live from the Mobile Veritex Community Bank Studios, located at Sam Houston Race Park.
Don't sweat the technique.
It's the Killer Bees.
Definitely a fan of the Killer Bees.
Now bringing you the fastest 3 hours in Houston sports radio. Here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Ooh, what up, H-Town? Hey, how we doing?
It's a
Friday edition of the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 FM. We are live from Sam Houston Race Park with a big night of racing and a huge weekend of racing ahead of us. We'll give you lots of details on that coming up, but Brian McDonald is in for Jeremy Branham, who's taking the day off, traveling with Cougars baseball. Ironically, to Cincinnati, VIP in it with Joe Mixon. But in all seriousness, he was on the same flight as Joe Mixon last night.
Yeah, he sent us a text in our group chat that Joe Mixon was on the flight, but he didn't even take a picture.
Well, screw the picture. I said, get the exclusive one-on-one. You could piss off all the Texans and everybody that and 610 and the highway to hell and just get us the one-on-one. He said, nah, he didn't want to do that.
You know, I mean, Jeremy often claims he's not a journalist. He's more of an influencer. So I think his true color shone yesterday.
That's...
Like, he had the opportunity to do the journalistic thing and get the one-on-one interview with new Texans running back Joe Mixon, but he doesn't have enough of that dog in him for the journalistic game.
A little disappointed. I would expect that the Twitchers will be all over him when they get a chance. So, BMAC, today is the day. It's a JV day. We've been waiting for it for quite a long time, probably longer than anybody wanted to. Justin Verlander on the hill tonight in Washington to take on the pesky Nats. And lo and behold, we have breaking news. The lineup comes out, and the bigger news than JV on the bump alone is, guess who's in center field for Justin Verlander?
Is it his personal center fielder, Mauricio Dubon?
It is, because as I think back to the many conversations that Mr. Branham and I have had about this subject, it was always Jeremy was in complete denial. It was just a coincidence. There's no way it ever could have been that Justin Verlander's personal center fielder was actually Mauricio Dubon. And now, lo and behold, Mauricio Dubon is making an appearance in center field on the night when Justin Verlander makes his debut with your Houston Astros for the year.
Yeah, when I first saw the tweet with the lineup, and I mentioned, like, oh, my God, Joel, like, the Mauricio Dubon's in center field tonight. My initial reaction was like, okay, I think I'm going to treat this as a coincidence, right? Like, I want to side on the idea that Verlander isn't making the call that Mauricio Dubon has to be a center fielder every time he takes the bump for the Houston Astros. But we're now not only spanning this across multiple years, we're also spanning this across multiple managers.
Indeed.
So, I mean, Joe Espada, did obviously work underneath Dusty Baker, so there maybe is some carryover there. But, I'm going to have to, I think, give some credence to this idea that Justin Verlander has informed the Astros that Mauricio Dubon will be his personal center fielder, because it's starting to feel like too much to be a coincidence at this point.
It really is, and the fact is you can't put this now, like you mentioned, on just Dusty Baker or try to say that this was Dusty's thought and not JV's, because now we've got a new regime, a new manager, and the same old center fielder. And the fact is that maybe it was a two down to one, because in the past, Justin Verlander was able to dictate his center fielder and his catcher. Now we're at least down to, and we don't know, but we're at least down to a center fielder. But if he decides that maybe he likes Caratini better than he likes Yiner, that'll be interesting to watch as well tonight, because of the fact that what JV wants, normally JV gets. And I think that also has, it starts with the fact that he's buddies with Jim Crane, and it goes right down the main street of, hey, he's a legend, he's a Hall of Famer, we give him what he wants.
Yeah, so if you haven't seen the lineup tonight, it is Altuve leading off, of course, playing second base. Yordan hitting second, but sorry, Joel, he's DHing tonight. He's not in left field. I don't know. Where are you at with your bet? Are you on?
I'm close. I think I'm close to 10.
Are you on pace?
Yeah, I'm well on pace, because I believe he's close to 10 games in left field, I believe.
So Alvarez, again, hitting second, DHing, then Bregman, then Tucker. Yonder Diaz catching, hitting fifth. So if Caratini was his preferred choice as catcher, they're not showing any indication of that as of now. Jeremy Pena moving up to sixth, a little bit higher than he'd been earlier in the season. Chaz McCormick, and we'll talk about this with Todd Callis, he's coming up at 4 o'clock today.
Yep.
But Chaz McCormick has really been slumping. He's hitting seventh in left field. Jose Abreu is back at first, hitting eighth, and Dubon, the personal center fielder for Verlander, is at nine. I mean, overall, I look at that. I look at that lineup. You know, your bench guys tonight are Singleton, Jake Myers, and Kessinger. I think I'd prefer Singleton at first base, but other than that, I don't really have a problem with this lineup.
I don't either. I think you're right. I think aside from a flip-flop at first base to give you the potential to have some kind of oomph at first base, I prefer Dubon's bat in center field. I believe he can do just – and Jeremy and I go back and forth on this. I know Jake has in the past been an above-average defensive center fielder. I think Dubon can do what Jake does, but he does so much more offensively that I'd rather have him in the lineup. And I like the fact that, you know, again, Joe Espada has proven to at least be flexible. If a guy's hitting well, he's going to move him up. If a guy's struggling a little bit, he can move him down. And it's not the dusty feng shui sway in the pawpaw's belly. It's just simply putting the best lineup and trying to get guys in the places where they will be most comfortable and most effective. And in this case, with Peña hitting hot, move him up. I love that.
Yeah, I like that. And look, I think it was game one. I think it might have been a bat one for Jake Myers when he hit a home run against the Yankees,
yeah.
Right? And since then, he's only had one home run since then. I mean, here we are, August 19th, only one home run since. And his batting average is down to .237. So I think we're starting to see kind of the career numbers of Jake Myers, you know, returning to their norm that he's had over his career. So I don't mind. I value Dubon's ability to be the super utility, but I wouldn't mind, even if it's kind of funny that, you know, he's quote unquote a personal center fielder for Justin Verlander. I don't know. The means that we're getting there are a little bit funny, but if the end result is Dubon playing more, I think he's the better hitter, so I'm fine with it.
See, here's my thing. You know, I already had major concerns about Jake. I had to kind of temper that displeasure when he did start the season after a hot spring training.
First at bat, man.
With a dinger. But I'm right back to saying I told you so, because I just don't trust him, and I don't think as highly of his defense as some might look at the numbers and think. But it, as you mentioned with Mauricio Dubon, the thing that's interesting to me is, yes, he's a super utility, but you have two glaring needs right now in this offensive lineup. It's first base and then figuring out center field.
Sure.
And so if center field can be solidified more by a guy that has proven to still be a stick in this lineup, when he's in the lineup offensively, he's effective. And if you're not losing a whole hell of a lot in center field, this is the guy that I want in center field. And then if you have to try and figure out different ways to kind of make do in the infield, so be it. But I like the fact that if he's in center field, one of those two positions offensively is more buttoned up.
Yeah, and I think maybe sometimes we get too caught up on where exactly he's playing. But the main thing that I think we need to get to is that Dubon's playing every day. Like, I would like to see him as the quote-unquote regular everyday center fielder. I'm with you on just not really believing in Jake Myers being a good enough offensive player to stay on the field. And then, you know, even though Dubon's in center, if you do have an injury to, you know, an infield position or a guy needs a day off, there's no reason on that day that Jake Myers could step in at center field and then Dubon moves around. But if you still get to the main part of it, which is Dubon playing every day, then I'll live with the rest of how else they get there.
Well, ideally, the other thing too, BMAC, is if Chaz McCormick was hitting the ball a little better, that was ideally the guy that I wanted to be in center field anyway. But you're right. If Chaz could be the guy that fills in one day in center field, or Jake's the guy you're going to give a start to in center field, it's just that one day when someone on the infield needs a break and Dubon goes there. But if he isn't truly indeed, and he is, and there's no reason to believe he's not your super utility, use him as Joe Espada feels necessary. And right now, because of the deficiencies we've seen, center field, first base, use him in center field, and then if he needs to come into the infield and spell Altuve for a day or Peña or Bregman, then you can put one of the other guys in center field. He goes to the infield. You're absolutely fine, because I don't trust the other bats off the bench, and right now this team needs to give its pitching staff all the runs it can, and that's why I think you got to fill those holes and just put Dubon in the lineup for the foreseeable future until things kind of sort themselves out.
Yeah, there's really not a single bat on. And that was kind of one of the problems that we've had when talking about what the Astros did this offseason. There's not a single bat really on the bench that you can turn to that you feel confident in. So Dubon really does need to be an everyday player. And you're right, you mentioned Chad's scuffling. I mean, I think part of what made the other players struggling so glaring, like if Chaz was hitting at the level that we saw last year, then I think you're probably excusing a lot of what you see from, you know, the 8 and 9 guys. But the 1 through 9 becomes a little less deep when Chaz is he's hitting right now .133 with a sub .500 OPS since April 5th.
Yeah, this is
he's been a bad offensive player since April 5th.
When the three of us were having these conversations going into the season, the one concern that I had was that he had a career year last year. That it was
certainly seems so.
It was a notch above what we had known him to be ever since he's been a major leaguer. And sure, there was one school of thought to say, hey, this is the springboarding of his career. Now this is the new bar that's been set. This is where he's going to go. But the alternative to that is what we're looking at right now, and you're hoping that it's not he doesn't sustain this level of effort offensively for the rest of the season, because now he's about as useful as Jake Meyers in the fact that as much as you relied on him.
Don't put Jake Meyers on him.
Well, but I'm saying, I mean, I need a whole lot more production. And even to me, it's not even one of those situations where meet me in the middle, kind of come back to the means and fall back. He could fall back a little bit from last season, but if he's going to start in the outfield, especially a corner outfield position in the major leagues, he's got to be a lot better.
Yeah, I mean, last year, I agree with you. We're probably going to look back when we get, 5 years from now, if pardon the phrase, Joel, when we look at the back of Chaz's baseball card, we're probably going to see 2023 as his career year. I mean, he had third on the team in OPS, maybe second on the team in OPS. He had an amazing season, and he added on like 19 steals to that. So we very well could see 2023 being the career year for Chaz McCormick. But, I mean, let's get back to Verlander. I mean, on the mound for the first time tonight and on the major league level for the Houston Astros, I believe he's going up against Mackenzie Gore, is he not?
Yes, he is.
So yep. Mackenzie Gore has been really good this season. Former top 10 prospect for the Padres, went over to the Nationals in the Juan Soto deal, and right now he's 2-0 with a 2.81 ERA, so the young guy certainly seems to be figuring it out. What are your expectations tonight for Justin Verlander in his first major league start of the season?
I think that's where it gets down to expectations versus hopes. You know, my hope is that he gives you six innings and gives up. It's a quality start. He gives up two runs. Two runs to a Nationals team that shouldn't be overpowering to him. But if he can keep it to six innings, three runs, or six innings, two runs, I'll take that out of him. I just don't know what to expect from him because he was so rocky in his two minor league starts, and I know you're working on things, and he's the first one to tell you, as long as he felt great, don't look at the results. But the fact is that at the end of the season last year, we saw that fall off, or the feeling like you're never going to get the old Justin Verlander that he used to be when he even in an Astros uniform, not the Tigers version. We know that's gone. But I think that even then, his fastball had taken another notch down. He looked like he was, not quite himself. And so my expectation would be that realistically, 6-3 is probably more fair. 5-3 might be more, along the norm. But I'll take what I can get at this point because I expect him to be better than a lot of the starters that have let this team down early in the season.
Yeah, I think I would settle with, and you pretty much nailed it right on the head with basically the line that Hunter Brown gave you in Tuesday's start against the Braves, which was six innings, two earned runs. He gave up five hits, struck out three. Because Verlander, like you mentioned, he's not quite the, or at least from the strikeout and velocity angles, he's not the Detroit Tigers version of Justin Verlander.
Not the old Astros.
Well, I mean, last year, once he got to the Astros, his ERA, or maybe, no, I'm sorry, I'm a little bit forgetting the timeline here. It was the second half of the season. This is a little bit more, or a little bit less than just his time with the Astros, or regardless. But his ERA second half of the season was below three. So I think he could still get done the ERA, the run prevention part of it, but it's not going to look the same. He's not going to hit the same velocity, and he's not going to have the 11-plus K per nine that he would have in the Tigers' days.
That's where I'm at. Like, the fastball has gone down a few notches on the miles per hour, but more so the strikeouts are way down from what they've been for the majority of his career.
3 years in a row they've been down,
You're not going to all of a sudden find the fountain of youth, and that kind of stuff is going to come back, especially dealing with a spring, getting into spring training when he got a setback due to his shoulder. So it's going to be interesting to see. What do you guys think? Where are you at? What are you looking for? What are your expectations versus what are your hopes for Justin Verlander tonight? Realistically or not, 713-780-3776. Call or text the show. You can reach us via Twitter, at SackedByBMAC, at Pac-Man Joel with a K, as we will be here till 6 p.m. Sam Houston Race Park, right off the Beltway 8, between the airport and 59. You know how to get to them. You know how to get to us. We'll be here until 6 o'clock. Back with more of the Killer Bees right after this. ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 FM.
Broadcasting live from the Mobile Veritex Community Bank Studios, located at Sam Houston Race Park. Here's the Killer Bees, Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Live from Sam Houston Race Park, it's a Friday edition of the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 FM. The Hive is alive, therefore BMAC is with us because Jeremy is not. Jeremy taking a day off, traveling with the Cougs baseball team on the way to Cincinnati as they went last night. BMAC and I will take you all the way till 6 o'clock right here as racing will be underway all weekend at Sam Houston Race Park. And we're going to be out here till 6, but you guys should stop by all weekend. Lots of great stuff going on. They got a diamond dig tomorrow night where they have, I believe, $23,000 worth of diamonds that are going to be hidden in the infield. God, I hope everybody finds them.
Yeah, apparently 10 guests will win a piece of jewelry from Shannon Jewelers Diamond Dig is the sponsor. It'll be after the 4th and 6th race. They're also going to have cupcakes, glasses, and hat giveaways.
Okay, cupcake.
Is that sponsored by Jeremy Booth?
Is that better than pumpkin? Maybe Jeremy Booth can get in on that instead of Hey Pumpkin.
Speaking of hats, I don't know if you looked ahead to May 3rd, Kentucky Derby weekend, but they're going to have a hat contest.
Oh.
So that'd be – I mean, even if – you know, even if watching horse racing isn't your biggest thing, I think people watching with seeing all the crazy hats would be quite a bit of fun.
Because, you know, Derby week at the actual Derby, that is literally some all-world people watching.
Oh, yeah. Elite-level people watching.
No doubt. So some of the other people were chiming in on the text line. Someone said, who cares as long as Verlander gets a win, 75-60. My only concern is he can go the distance or be the next Presley. Please text back what you mean by be the next Presley, unless you mean Elvis. I don't know what you're talking about, but in terms of going the distance, don't count on it. I would think that he's probably on a pitch count of 80-ish or less.
Yeah, I don't remember what his final pitch count was for his last start with the Hooks last week, but I know his longest minor league start in this rehab was 4 innings. I think it was 4 innings around 70 pitches.
Okay.
So I can't imagine, what would you put the number at, like 85 pitches
I think it's hovering right around 80. I don't think they want to push him too far. You know that you are dealing with, but I don't think it matters in this situation, like trying to save arms in the pen. I think this is one of those deals where he's such a vital cog to this team long term this season that you can't take any chances.
No.
And that's why I think that no matter where they are, and you know he's going to be a bulldog and want to stay out there, I think it's going to be right around 80, probably max around 85.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good number. And it does help that the Astros had the day off yesterday, so hopefully that should mean all arms available for today's game, and then you figure it out for the rest of the series over the weekend. Hope that Javier, which, I mean, that's never a guarantee, but hopefully Javier and Blanco can –
look.
If Verlander goes short, hopefully they can pick up some of the slack and save arms on Saturday and Sunday.
As good as some of the young players are on the Nats, overall you should be looking at a series that you can win. And the other thing is that you have your three best pitchers right now going because you have JV, Blanco, and Javier, but not in that order, JV, Javier, and Blanco. You have those three guys going. That's better than you've had in terms of three straight starters that you could go to that you can rely on. So you have to capitalize on everything right now because you played a lot of really good teams early in the season. You lost a lot of close games. You were outscored 31-4 from the seventh inning on and lost a lot of games you probably could have or should have won. Now you need to kind of reverse fortunes, pull the 180, get some more wins in the win column, and go from there. 4-3-2-1 says, JV gives up one or two bombs, two or three runs, 4 to 5 hits, 5 innings. Okay, 3 runs in 5 innings.
Not a quality start.
Not a quality start, but it might be enough to win this game. You're mentioning the fact that they're facing a fairly good pitcher, but at the same time, this is a really good hitting lineup, and this is probably the best offensive lineup they could put out there, sans Singleton for Abreu. So I would take that from Justin Verlander in his first start back because he's traditionally not a guy that's going to put the foot down on the gas pedal and really try and shut a team completely down. He is kind of susceptible to giving up some bombs. So if he gives up 3 runs in 5 innings, I still think that's a game you should win.
Yeah, I guess the question would be then, like, if I offered to you 5 innings, 3 runs, that's a number you would sign up for versus the unknown?
I think I would because this is his first start.
It would be better than his minor league starts because those minor league starts he had two. He had one for Sugarland and one for the Hooks down in Corpus. 11 earned runs in 7 innings.
Well, that's where I was going. I think that based on it's his first start in the bigs this season and couple it with the fact that the two starts in the minors didn't knock anybody's socks off or say the old JV's coming back and when he's back he's going to roll – I'll take that as the opening first baby step to getting him back to at least, you know, the kind of Verlander that we can stomach at the start of the rotation. So I guess at this point, yes, I would take five innings, three runs, and learn to live to fight another start.
Would there be any sort of performance, and I there's obviously got to be a line here, but is there any sort of performance where you're go so far beyond, well, oh, it's just his first start, to where you actually would get worried? Like, because I think a lot of us, and me included, sounds like you as well, are willing to be completely dismissive of the two bad starts in his minor league rehab starts. He's a 41-year-old, you know, Cy Young MVP-level pitcher. He's working on stuff. I'm not really worried about minor league rehab stat line. But if he goes out and gives up, I don't know, six runs, five runs, where are we at? Like, what would it take for you to watch his start tonight and go, uh-oh, we may have a problem here?
It's actually kind of easy, B-Mac. I mean, because of the fact that, unfortunately, we've seen enough of it to start the season. If he gives you a Hunter Brown-esque start in Kansas City, if he gives you some
record breaking,
yeah, I mean, if you start talking about some of the young guys that have had a chance to start for the Astros this year and go, that's not what you want to see. You want to see if there's a start that worries me, that he struggles with his command a little bit, the fact that he gives up multiple runs early in the game and then maybe gives up runs in multiple innings, then I'm going to start, you know, being a little bit more concerned because of the fact that the situation matters, right? The where this team sits right now is different than they've sat in years past and in the recent history of the Golden Era, to where you're relying on him more than maybe you ever have, even when he was the horse at the start of the rotation. So you need a guy that doesn't give you reason for pause. You need a guy that gives you reason for optimism that this was the first one. He's going to continue to get better. He looks like he's still got his A game. So that's where I would be.
It sounds like what I'm hearing you say is the Astros need a stopper.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt. I mean, look, they got two guys in the rotation you can count on. There's five spots in that rotation, and they'd like to go to six. If any of those other things are going to be true and they're going to be a competitive baseball team, you have to have four of the five guys you can rely on while you figure out who your fifth starter is going to be. And right now, yeah, Hunter Brown looked better in his last start. Yes, J.P. France looked better in his last start. I can see those guys being another one of those guys. But at the front of the rotation, I need a veteran that can pitch, not throw, that knows how to, you know, bulldog his way out of situations. And you need a Verlander that is kind of a stopper.
Yeah, it's like you're facing a Nationals team, and it's easy to, you know, the crap on the Nationals. They haven't been a good team really since they won the World Series. But, I mean, sadly enough, they're sitting at eight wins. The Astros are at six. So as much as we want to crap on the Nationals, the Astros are looking up at them in the standings. So, and that kind of leads me to where the question I have going into the series. When you look ahead and what's coming up for the Astros, including this series, their next four, you have before you get to a Mariners series, which will be really important next month. You have the Nationals this weekend. You go to face the Cubs, who are a winning team at 11-7. You got two games at the Rockies, and then the Guardians come to town, who are 13-6, leading American League Central. Yeah, and right after that, if that wasn't like, cause there's two winning teams there, so that's not exactly completely filled with cupcakes. Once you get done with that stretch, I mentioned the Mariners. The Mariners come into town, then you're at the Yankees and at the Tigers, who are both above 500. Seeing this schedule coming up with the Cubs, the Guardians, the Mariners, the Yankees, the Tigers, I'm kind of looking at this National Series, tell me if you think this is crazy, but almost as a must-sweep for the Astros.
I'm not going to say must-sweep, but when I was thinking about it, looking at it this morning, it's more like your mentality now has to go back to a mentality that I talked about in years past when you were kind of in the driver's seat. But it works both ways. Just win the series. I don't think it's a must-sweep, but it's a must-win for the series. You have to take two out of three. You have to show that you can right the ship, because sooner rather than later, if you start winning series, whether you sweep them or not, you're going to get your record back above 500. You're going to get back to respectability and beyond, and you're going to be competitive in the American League again. So I don't think it's to the level of desperation like down the stretch late in the season when you're chasing a team by four or five games when every win is hyper important. I think series wins are what's really important right now, that you go out and take two out of three, three out of four, depending on how long each series is. And in this case, you take two out of three from a Nationals team that you still are better than on paper, should be better than at the end of the year, and need to be better than to get back into respectability in the American League.
Yeah, no, I think you're certainly taking the more logical approach than probably I am here. I mean, that is
so. You're
right.
If you think they need to be, are you more desperate?
Yeah, no, I do feel desperate. Maybe I'm being spoiled Astros fan. Even though I grew up during some of the lean years of the 90s before they were getting either missing the playoffs or they're tipping their hat to the Braves pitchers every year in the postseason. So maybe I'm being spoiled here, but look, I mean, the math is going to add. I mean, I think you're right. The math of, you know, you win two out of three, and you do that over a long period of time, it's going to work itself out. But when you look at 6-14, it's just like, man, they got to go on a run here at some point. And when you go into a series against a team like the Nationals, who, even though they have more wins than you, they are a sub-500 team, and you're throwing out Verlander, Javier, Blanco, your best three pitchers, it feels like I would walk away with just a 2-1 series win. Not speaking for you, not speaking for the listeners, but speaking for myself, I would walk away feeling disappointed.
As long as they win the series, I'm not going to feel disappointed. But the follow-up to that to you would be, of the three guys pitching this weekend, is it safe to say Verlander's the guy you trust the least?
For this weekend, yes.
I think that's realistic.
Specifically for this weekend, yes. Like I mean, over the course of the season, Verlander, I have full confidence will round into form and start to look like the Verlander of the second half that we saw last year, which, again, people forget it. They see his season-long ERA and like, yeah, okay, maybe he's slipping a little bit. But his second-half ERA last year was under 3. So we started to see the old Justin Verlander. He is old. But the Justin Verlander numbers that we've come to expect over the course of his career. But for specifically this weekend, this start, given, you know, the quality of his performance in the minor leagues, given that he's going to be on a pitch count, given that he hasn't pitched in a major league game in I don't know how many months it is now. I'm not going to try to do Joe math on the air. But, yeah, I think I would have more confidence in Javier, who's been pretty much great in every single start. Same thing with Blanco.
It's interesting because I think some of the orange Kool-Aid drinking Astros fans of Twitter have made an appearance on the text line, because we've got a couple like this one from 6015. I got a bad feeling about this. I think JV gets shelled.
Oof.
Okay, don't really care for that one a whole lot.
No.
Followed up by another sunshine and roses. Bet the entire ranch on the Washington Nationals.
Wow, tonight?
Yeah.
Or just man?
I guess more people than not are looking at the starts in the minors and thinking there's something to this. Now, 3311 says, how do the Space Cowboys feel about JB trying things out at their record's expense?
They don't care.
I'm sure they care to some degree, but that's...
No, because they'll fake JV for the gate.
But the flip side of that for me is JB's stat chasing. And I don't want to call him like a stat chaser for his career, but we know that the wins and the strikeouts are very important to him right now.
Sure.
And then he also has a vested option to where he's got to pitch a certain amount of innings.
140, yeah.
So therefore, there is credence to the fact that when he goes to the minors, he does not care about the situation the team is in. He is trying to figure things out, maybe work on a pitch that he's been working on, work on like controlling and placing a few pitches differently than maybe in the past, so that he can fine-tune it so that when he gets back to the bigs, he can chase the stats, do what he needs to do, and get where he and the team need to get to. I'm not worried about what he does in the minors, but when you give up, I mean, a guy that's been that good of a major league pitcher for that many years against minor league lineups, I just feel like there's something that to be leery of to some degree when he gets beaten up a little bit.
And I think that is certainly, or at least possibly, a byproduct of the overall feelings the Astros this season have given us. Like, I mean, you look at Verlander's numbers, 11 earned runs through 7 innings and over his 2 minor league rehab starts, and obviously that's not good. But I think if the Astros, you know, if you were to flip their record, instead of being 6-14, they were 14-6. You know, everyone's having good vibes. Everyone's feeling confident. The Astros are looking like the team we expected them to be. Then I think people would be a lot more willing to dismiss, like, oh, it's a former Cy Young Award winner. It's a former MVP. Justin Verlander's 41. He's done this 1,000 times. He's working on stuff. But because we're looking through the lens of, holy crap, the Astros are bad, they have the second worst record of the American League behind only the White Sox, then viewing Verlander's minor league rehab starts are tunneled through that vision of, holy crap, everything, you know, the sky is falling. And I think that gets misinterpreted just because we're all our heads are all spinning because of this bad start.
So let's again spin through some of these, because again, now we're looking and searching for positivities as well as the negatives. But we followed it up as 5895 says, I'll be fine as long as he's in the top four of our current pitchers in the rotation after tonight. If he looks like he should be number six or number seven, then I'll start to panic. I think that one start in might be too quick to, like, push the panic button.
It's also a low bar.
But I feel where they're coming from simply because of the fact that they've dug a hole for themselves. So, like you said, he's a stopgap. You're relying on this guy tonight. Now, here are the two that always make me laugh, because one of them is just a guy that likes to bang. He listens every day, and all he wants to do is bang on us, no matter how wrong he is.
Okay.
And I'm assuming it's a him. Could be my mistake. But first of all, I'm going to give you the negative first, because this is 6030, who loves to come at us. And I lost it here for a second. Hold on.
Uh-oh.
He always bangs on. He said, team is going to lose two out of three. This team is trash. So you can stop trying to butter up people like you did all of last season, trying to convince everyone this was the best lineup ever. First of all, I don't think we ever said the best lineup ever. But, oh, by the way, because I did want to follow it up with reality, which is this team was it OPS? And one of the best offensive teams in the American League, if not the best offensive team in the American League. They're second least in strikeouts, fourth highest in all of baseball in OPS. So if that is indeed the case, you are wrong, sir. We are right. And don't put words in our mouth, but continue to listen on a daily basis, because I don't know why you continue to do this just to stir the pot.
Yeah, look, I think some people are going to be
honest.
It's
not the offense.
No, well.
Except for Abreu.
I'm mostly with you. I do. If we were going to blame the offense, and maybe this is something we could carry over, but I think you could blame maybe the consistency.
Sure.
Because they have nights where they score 10,
but
they score
the best.
8, they score 9, and then one run the next day.
Right, but that's baseball. Like,
sure.
That's every team in baseball. Now, the good thing is they're not going and completely disappearing after double-digit games as much as they did a year ago. But at the same time, if you are the number one team in the American League and in the top four in baseball in OPS, you're doing something offensively. You are
sure.
Not disappearing on offense. So it's outlandish to go and keep texting the show that we were wrong, thinking that, and putting words in our mouth about how great they were. This is a damn good offensive lineup.
Yeah, I think the frustration comes from, I'm just looking at a stretch between the Rangers, the Royals, and then back to the Rangers series into the Braves series. So the last game against the Rangers, when they were at Arlington, they scored 10 runs. They go to Kansas City, score 3-2-3. You then face the Rangers again. You score 8, 9, and 8, in which you take 2 out of 3. Which is amazing. And then you score 1, 2, 4. So I think that's maybe it's unfair. Maybe, as you said, that's just baseball. That's just the natural ups and downs of a long season. But I think maybe that's where some fans, if they are putting some blame on the offense, are coming from. Not so much that the offense has been bad, but you just have these wild swings where you go one game scoring 10 runs to the next day scoring 1. And even though the 10 runs is going to make the overall numbers look pretty good, those just complete stinker games, especially when you're facing teams like that you feel like you should beat, which I think a lot of Astros fans felt about going into the Kansas City series. We obviously know now that they're a better team than we expected. But
they
I think that might be worse.
Division.
Yeah, that might be a source of some of the frustration.
It might be. But, you know, I think, again, a lot of the panic, the quick to bring negative to the table is centered around the slow start. And when you dig deeper on the slow start, I've been adamant about the fact that you didn't get your doors blown off, you know, throughout the course of the first 15 games of the season. You were in every game in the Yankee series. I think, quite honestly, you should have won at least 2, if not 3 of the 4 from the Yankees, and you were in position to do so. So that already was a positive for me that this team isn't that bad. The one series that just drives me nuts is the Kansas City series, because it really is inexplicable based on the fact you thought they were starting to play better, the offense hadn't let you down, and then it starts with horrible starting pitching, but you're just going, my goodness, that was the one that kicked you right between, you know, the left and the right, and going, it's just that one is why I think everybody is kind of a little bit more off than maybe they should be.
Yeah, I think, look, I mean, if we're trying to rewrite history, I think if the Astros go into Kansas City and win 2 out of 3, even though they would still have a losing record at that point, they would be, what would they be? They would be 8-12 instead of 6-14. I still think we would still obviously be disappointed. It'd still be a losing record. It'd still be 4 games under .500. But I think you'd be more willing to, I guess, see or play the the song of, okay, this is a team that's going to figure it out. This is a team that may be slumping early because the schedule's really tough and it's going to lighten up a little bit going forward. But you get swept in the way you do against the Kansas City Royals, especially with that Hunter Brown performance when they lose 11-2 in Game 2. Or maybe that – actually, that was that Game 3 when they lost 13-3. I lose count. They had a couple blowouts in that series. But if you take 2 out of 3 from Kansas City, then I think people are looking at this a lot differently, yeah.
Yeah, so, okay. Are we late?
We need to get to break.
We got to get to a break. We're going to come back with more of this. You guys want to get in on the conversation? Lots more to get to because, again, a lot of finger pointing going on. Maybe it started me to really kind of, you know, double down with the Royals series. But, you know, who do you blame the most? A lot of people pointing the finger at Abreu. A lot of people pointing the finger at Espada. Who are you going to blame? The starting pitching, it can be rolled into that as well. Injuries could be blamed. We want to hear from you. 713-780-3776. Call or text. Hit us up on Twitter. It is BMAC and Joel on a Friday on the Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 FM.
You're back with the Killer Bees
on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Broadcasting live from the Mobile Veritex Community Bank Studios, located at Sam Houston Race Park.
Hey, back, as the announcer has so eloquently put it, we are back at Sam Houston Race Park, getting ready for a full weekend of racing out here throughout the weekend. Your chance to get involved, bet on the ponies, have some fun, lots of things going on. They've got their 30th anniversary party coming up. Center club level, cupcakes, glasses, and hat giveaways. Shannon Jewelers Diamond Dig after the 4th and 6th races tomorrow night. $23,000 in jewelry is going to be given away. 10 guests will win a piece of jewelry at tomorrow night's festivities, April 27th. They have tequila and taco tasting.
Now we're talking. Ooh, now we're talking.
Okay, 6:30 to 9:30 on the club level. Tasting card for $20, good for 5 tequila tastings. Tasting card $10, good for 3 tacos.
So for $30, I could get 5 tastings of tequila and 3 tacos?
Pretty much.
That's a damn good party.
And then on the 27th, they have a comedy show featuring Jesse Payton and Dusty Sims in the pavilion. For all this information and more, you can visit shrp.com. And again, like I said, we will be here till 6 p.m. this evening. As you can tell, it's getting rowdy as people are watching photo finishes and races down to the wire.
I can't tell if they lost dramatically or won dramatically, but either way, the emotions are flying here.
No question about it. Text line is alive today. It's unbelievable. And some of the swings and misses that we're getting along the way with some of the people that are bringing value to the show. So there's plenty more to get to there. Ocho's wanting your opinion on NFL draft stuff. We can get to that later in the show.
Oh, yeah, we got stuff on that coming up.
3062 says the offense is raking, but we were able to overlook that in the past, that the staff was freaking nails. Now that the staff has to be overcome because of lackluster pitching, more attention has to be paid there. I mean, that's a fair point. Look, no matter how good the offense is, the real problem is the fact that the pitching, it has been an issue. You expected the middle of the bullpen to be problematic, but but the two things that you didn't expect were, one, you'd have more injuries in the starting rotation, therefore it would be more depleted and less effective, and you'd see some of these young guys. And then the back of the bullpen was supposed to be absolutely shut down after the 6th inning, and Abreu has struggled. I mean, right down the line, all 3 guys have struggled, and that's given you more angst and more reason to have a couple of more antacids.
Yeah, not that I need a whole lot of reasons. My diet is not good. But, yeah, look, I mean, you mentioned the back end of the bullpen struggles. I mean, saying they've struggled is almost underselling it. I think this came up on the show the other day, but the lowest ERA right now amongst your back end, your Brian Abreu, Ryan Pressly, and Josh Hader, is Brian Abreu with a 6 ERA. That's the best one.
That's awful.
Ryan Pressly's above 9. Josh Hader's above 8. Certainly, obviously, you expect him to come back, you know, more towards their mean, and maybe that is a reason for optimism that the natural progression to the mean will bring their numbers down, which also means they'll pitch better, and hopefully that will lead to more wins from the team. But I think, as you mentioned there, from what the texter said, I think they're spot on. You can't really dismiss, even when talking about the offensive maybe inconsistencies, you can't really dismiss the starting pitching part of that out of the equation. Outside of Javier and outside of Blanco, it's just been absolutely awful for the overall. I mean, the first game of the Rangers series here, they score 8 runs and lose by 4. I mean, the offense scored 8 runs.
Right.
If you score 8 runs in a game, you should win.
Look at the Rangers yesterday. They start lighter for the first time. He gives up seven, but they win the game 9-7
right.
because your offense is that good. If your offense is as good as the Astros are, more times than not, you're supposed to win those games. You're not expecting a pitching staff that should be better than the Rangers on paper and on the field. Can't get the job done, especially with the amount of money and the resumes and the back of the baseball cards of a lot of the pitchers on this staff.
Yeah, look, it's all been turned upside down when that trip through the rotation happened, where you had, you know, Hunter Brown only get two outs. You had Blake Keeney only get, I believe, one out. And then you had, I believe, Spencer Arrighetti only went three innings, and the J.P. France had like a three-inning start mixing there. And that turned into the Astros. We saw just have an absolute parade, basically, from Sugar Land up to Minute Maid Ballpark, bringing in all these new fresh arms, these relief bullpen guys, because their bullpen was just getting hammered because they're having to pitch six, seven innings every night, if not even, you know, more in some cases. So it's hard to look at anything else when that is happening, because that is so disruptive to the bullpen, then to the starters the next day, because then the next day starters expected to do more because the bullpen's tired. The offense is expected to score more because they're into the Astros are into their bullpen in the second inning. I mean, it just throws everything off to a level that it's hard to point at anything else as a reason for blame other than the starting pitching in those cases.
You know, and some of the other text messages, 4321, we can't forget that for some reason, coincidentally, we never give Verlander a lot of offensive support. If he only gives up three runs and the bullpen's playing like they do, the team actually might be in trouble if we're not hitting the ball and supporting him. Look,
yeah.
The same way that Dubon has been a mainstay in center field, they're not wrong. For some reason,
no.
You can't. It's like, what's with the batter's eye? What's with the home record? You can't put your finger on it, but they don't traditionally give JV a whole lot of run support.
Yeah, that's such a weird thing, because you see that occasionally with random guys throughout, you know, a team's history. Like, I wasn't old enough to be watching a lot of these games at the time, but you look at some years for Nolan Ryan when he was here with the Astros, he's got like a sub-2 ERA and a record of like 8-14 because he just was getting no run support. I remember there was a pitcher for the Astros in the 90s named Tim Redding who was actually pretty good, you know, a couple years, but he just would never get that many wins because in the games where he would start, the team would put up absolutely nothing. So that is a concern today. Like, I'm with you. Like, I would probably take five innings, three earned, just as a reasonable expectation for Verlander's first start in, I don't know, 8 months, whatever it's been. But you're going against a pretty damn good pitcher, Mackenzie Gore, so it's not unreasonable to expect the Astros offense to struggle. And if they do against a good pitcher, three runs allowed for Verlander with the bullpen struggles might not be good enough.
Now, where are you on this? 3311 says, point the finger everywhere. It's not the pitching, the bats, or the defense. It's the state of the game. The others have been too mediocre to compensate for the good games. I don't think that's the case, but I don't know where you are on that.
I don't know. There is a little bit of everything, but again, I go back to, it's hard to blame anything other than the starting pitching when you're having that run through the order that they had, with Arrighetti throwing three innings and J.P. France having a three-inning start and Blake Keeney having a one-out start and Hunter Pence having a two-out start, literally setting a major league record for most hits allowed in the first inning, not to even ignore the fact that they also gave up 9 earned runs in that first inning. So There is a lot of blame to be passed around, but
well,
I think
and
really
on that note, 7560 talks about something that we started talking about yesterday again. You got to blame the owner for going after aged players. Investor over experience on playing decisions always loses. We need help at general manager, not necessarily a new GM, just better help. Well, that goes to the tweets I was going at yesterday. The Crane Gang ain't getting it done. And the Crane Gang now was supposed to hand over the reins to Dana once Dana got the gig. And instead, now because of Reggie Jackson and the podcast, we find out even more insight to what we didn't want to know, which is you can't really blame Dana Brown at this point, because it seems like it's decision by committee, and the committee can overrule Dana Brown at any time.
Yeah, I had this conversation with a buddy at lunch today, and it's something that I've kind of been mapping out as a possible topic for us in the future, but like, I don't know if what we could even find out if Dana Brown is a competent manager this year, because it from the outside looking in, and we obviously aren't privy to the exact workings of the front office of the Houston Astros, but it certainly feels like at times that Jim Crane and his buddies with Reggie Jackson and Jeff Bagwell are coming to the decision of what they want to do and then telling Dana Brown, go get it done. it doesn't feel like Dana Brown has been given the power, the authority, and the autonomy. I'm going to butcher that word.
Autonomy.
I shouldn't have attempted that. That was bad. Bad.
I'm here to help. Jeremy
bad
thinks it's a negative. I'm here to help.
Bad self-awareness by me. But he doesn't have all that like a normal, powerful general manager, I think, would have. And maybe that's a product of Jim Crane feeling some mistrust from how it ended with Jeff Luhnow, seemingly not getting along with James Click. And after not trusting a general manager, after not liking the next one, maybe he's just now at a spot where he's feeling like he has to take that power away from the general manager. Because it certainly seems like Bagwell, Reggie Jackson, and Jim Crane are making the decisions. And then Dana Brown is just the man to actually go and execute
B-Mac,
their vision.
I don't think that Dana Brown, in my opinion, and I don't know if we'll ever know fully, but it's because of, again, what Reggie said, on top of how uneasy I felt since Dana Brown got the job. I don't know if this is the job Dana Brown signed up for, but I certainly believe in my heart of hearts he's never been able to do the job the way he wanted to do it. I think this is even more reason why you should feel sorry for James Click and realize that he got railroaded out of town because the owner was demanding and wanting to play fantasy baseball while he was trying to actually run a Major League Baseball team like an experienced general manager. And I don't know that any general manager in the league is going to want this gig as long as that's the setup.
That is an interesting point to this, and it kind of goes back to a conversation we've had. I know we had it on Wednesday. I don't remember if it was after you had to leave or if it was before. But, I mean, I think it's more than just me. I know Jeremy's brought it up. But I'm really starting to get some Jerry Jones vibes from Jim Crane.
Someone texted that, I believe, too, and I was driving home. I think you're right.
Yeah,
and I agree.
It's hard to ignore that. And it goes back to what you're saying about how what I was saying before with what it feels like is Jim Crane basically taking the decisions from himself, Bagwell, and Reggie Jackson and just passing along marching orders then to Dana Brown. And the maybe how future general managers will view this job. Like, if they're looking from the outside, you run off a good general manager in James Click. It seems like you've taken a power away from a very worthy candidate in Dana Brown, who was a very hot candidate at the time the Astros hired him. If you're looking on the outside, like, man, do I want to come to the Astros and be their next general manager? I'd have a lot of questions for Jim Crane before I'd be willing to take that
job. You might very well at some point, Brian, down the road, say 5-10 years, you might be looking at two guys that turn out to be above average general managers in Major League Baseball that you had under contract and let get away or simply forced away because of the way owning this team you chose to run everything by committee.
Yeah, I know. There's no doubt about it, especially with James Click. I mean, obviously the book is still out on Dana Brown, and I honestly don't think we're really even going to get an answer to, you know, how good of a general manager Dana Brown is.
But I think
right
if Dana Brown has another interview somewhere in baseball down the road, if this doesn't work out, all it's going to take is the word of mouth to travel that, hey, his hands were tied. He never got a chance to be his own guy. And that's going to be enough for another team, especially a young team, where he has shown to be the propensity to be able to analyze talent and be able to find and then lock up good quality Major League Baseball players to where some team's going to go, hey, their loss, our gain. They screwed it up by not letting him do his job. We'll give you the control you need. We'll let you roll and believe that he can do the job.
Yeah, I think so. I think people from the outside are realizing what's happening. We saw in that article from Ken Rosenthal, I don't remember if it was earlier this week or the week before, pointing out some of the maybe the odd workings of the Astros front office. But I think people would look at Dana Brown, realize that his hands have been tied by Jim Crane and this Astros panel of Hall of Famers with Bagwell and Reggie Jackson making the decisions, and then just look back at his track record when he was the second in command in Atlanta with all the great signing or the great moves he made with Spencer Strider,
Michael Harris,
not only drafting them but then getting them locked up to team-friendly deals, paying off, you know, their first couple years of arbitration and then into what would have been their free agency. I think people will look at that, and especially since those were the reasons why he was a hot candidate for to become the Astros general manager, and they would still see him as a valuable candidate going forward.
That's what I'm saying. You would hate the fact that the golden era of Astros baseball was basically thwarted at the end by an overzealous, over-controlling owner that let two quality general managers get out the door because of personality conflicts and his ability to want to control everything.
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, it's going to be something that I think is going to end up on a 30 for 30
in
about
possible.
10 years.
All right, that's the first hour of the show. We still got two to go. One in the books, two to go. Second hour of the show coming up next. Plenty more to get to as we continue
Todd
to roll
Kalas
on.
Todd Kalas up next.
Todd Kalas will join us, the voice of the Astros, joining us from Washington as we get ready for this big series and the start of Justin Verlander's 2024 season. All that and more coming up next. Todd Kalas right around the corner. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5, 92.5 FM.